Hi, good morning or late morning. It's really great to be here, and we'd like to thank Brian Bridges for inviting us and Caroline Elwin to get us here. We're really pleased to be at ISTA, because how we want to use this keynote in many ways to introduce you to Listening Across Disciplines, which is a HSC-funded network project in the first instance that Anna and I instigated and did between 2016 and 17. I hope I got these dates right. And then lead you into Listening Across Disciplines 2, which is the kind of follow-on slightly longer three-year project that we will be starting in January next year. So it's like a bit of an inaugural, if you will, to this project and to introduce you to its concerns. And also to... it's not on. Now it is on. Can you hear me now? So that... I hope you heard a little bit of that. So to inaugurate the project for us as a kind of starting point, and also to enroll you already in its participatory elements and what we could maybe do in between disciplines, cross-disciplinary and interdisciplinary. So we called this talk Accessing the Disciplinary Hinterland Through Listening, sort of taking a bit the key from the conference concerns, but also a very current concerns of walls and partitions, and who wants to be part of what and who doesn't want to be part of what else. And we felt that there was a mirror in politics and in academia of disciplinary boundaries. What are the disciplinary boundaries? And what maybe could be gained from peering over these boundaries or ignoring these boundaries and looking at the hinterlands of different disciplines and of what crossovers could be gained? And what are the hinterland as something that is kind of a bit the unknown, the unspoken, that's not at the forefront, and yet it most decidedly creates the forefront. It most decidedly creates what a discipline can be in this instance, what, how things are done methodologically, what materials are involved, what questions are and can be asked. And so while the hinterland is not seen, it decides those things and it creates the boundaries. And we felt, so rather than meeting in the foreground with all the kind of known vocabularies, if we meet in the hinterland, if we meet where these things happen, maybe through listening, different relationships could be struck up. Maybe that unknown, the unagreed, things that we don't know how to agree on about could be found, and different accesses, different portals into interdisciplinary and cross-disciplinary working could be found. Now, that sounds all quite abstract and vague, but hopefully if I go into the actual project, that I can clarify that a little bit more. So Listening Across Disciplines was a project, was a network project in the first instance. And see, this is the website that goes with it. I hope you can see it all. I can even make it bigger. So it was a network project that aimed to start somewhere. So it was between myself as a sound artist and the biomedical acoustic engineer. So two things that seemingly could meet because they're both about sound, at least on the surface. But then building from our meeting point a whole network of meeting points of other disciplines and people who we felt were potentially listening, or were they? And how could we all meet, and how could we discuss how we are listening, and whether there is any relevance in listening together, whether anything could be gleaned by bringing humanities, arts, technology subjects, the sciences, and the social sciences together to discuss how do we listen. We did this by creating three network events. I've got to go up a little bit. One that sort of really focused on the environment, on geography, but also architecture, urban planning, bringing people together in these areas, having a sort of colloquial style whole day workshopping around what are the current issues, what are the problems, are there problems, is there anything we can do together, or do we just not speak the same language? Is there a benefit in meeting? Then the next one was very much about bodies and materiality, so speech, the voice, medical issues, but also issues, more philosophical issues or identity politics issues of who are we, what are we, how do we work together, anthropology, forensics, etc. was present. And the last issue was very much about listening to language, culture, and artifacts. So how do we listen to language together? Because we all listen to language maybe for very particular purposes, and therefore we hear very particular things, and because we hear what we need to hear, what we feel we need to hear in a language. And what are the things we do with listening? How do we use listening, etc.? And you can explore this website. This website is still online, and you can also meet and see older people who were involved with their various pictures and background stories of why they were there and why they were invited and so on this website. And obviously we also have a Beyond the Network section, because it really still tries to get on. Oh yeah, and there's a podcast of each of the network meetings should you be interested in what was actually discussed. So we made radio programs from these meetings to kind of sum up and also publicize what are these discussions and what are the questions. And it was very interesting, the questions that sort of came up. And one of the consensus we had is that we don't speak the same language, that we don't have the vocabularies where science and technology and art could really interact and make this useful. So consensus became a very interesting and important issue. What is consensus? What is consensus in the arts? What is consensus in science? Can we make it useful? Can we build a vocabulary? Can we build a glossary that could make us work together? Another one that was very important was about how the methodology, what was the status of listening? Was it something that was itself in the foreground, so that the sonic material was the thing we had? Or did it have to be translated into something else to find legitimacy? So what is the sort of legitimacy, the usefulness of sound itself? And these were kind of issues we then developed, and I will talk about where we developed them too later. But first of all, how we're going to structure this talk is that Anna will talk about listening in the sciences, and I will talk about listening in the arts. And in this sort of juxtaposition, things might already come out. And we then will start to talk. We have questions to each other that we will publicly perform for you. And then we would like you to help us also answer or at least engage in these questions in the sense of what is a listening across disciplines. But so at this stage, I hand over to Anna. Let me get back to the PowerPoint.
Thank you. So for me, the network started with an email in my inbox from somebody I'd never heard of. And it was a bit like, do you get those emails that say, we'd like you to be the editor-in-chief of the Journal of General Stuff? And I looked at it and thought, quite busy. But something about it made me think, actually, it could be interesting. And I phoned Salome and we had a discussion, and I began to think, actually, this is really interesting, and this is something I would like to be involved in. What I do, I call myself a biomedical acoustic engineer, and my background is engineering. I've got a degree in electronics, and we have a specialist department at Southampton called the Institute of Sound and Vibration Research, where we look at all sorts of sound and analysis. But it's very much from an engineering perspective. And what I do is I use sound to solve problems in the biomedical domain. So I record sound and I analyze it, and I try to use it to solve problems like diagnosis of disease or monitoring of healthcare treatments or efficacy of treatments in clinical trials. And I'm particularly interested in anything in the respiratory tract. So I listen to lungs and to speech sounds. I've worked in snoring. I've looked at speech patterns in Alzheimer's disease and whether we can use those to predict onset of the disease early on, or whether we can use them to predict progress of the disease and to adapt treatments, because the speech sounds act as a sort of outcome measure for how well the treatment's working. So very much from an engineering perspective. And the sorts of sounds I listen to, I'll play you a couple of examples. So this is actually something that I find quite difficult. I'm just stuck because it's going backwards, Anime. Can you just... Thank you. that one's a person who's just started smoking. And again, I can't work out this backwards of computer of yours. This is about 10 years in. And this is about 20 years of smoking. I'm going to need you again. Not a Mac user. So that's sound recorded through a stethoscope on the chest wall of a smoker. And what I do with that is I record it. If when I'm recording, I haven't been able to check the levels by some means, seeing something on the computer screen or a recording device, I have a quick listen to make sure that it's recorded and that the quality is suitable. Then I take the data as a digital recording into a system and I do some mathematical analysis on it, and sometimes I plot a picture. So I turn it into something that looks like this, and that's a sort of post-analysis picture. So the different colours, one is the sound of the breathing that you can hear and the others are the other events that you heard. So that's a single breathing cycle there. And so I thought, well, this is great because I do all this work with sound, and here we are, we're going to look at listening and maybe the arts can bring something. And then I thought, well, actually, there's a problem. I don't really listen to the sounds that I record. My general practice is not to listen. I'm not really interested in them as anything except a stream of numbers that I can pull stuff out of. Is it really legitimate for me to take part in something that is to do with listening? Because apart from that quick check, did it record or did it not, I don't. So then I started to ask myself, why not? And that's when I really got interested in this and said, well, I'm in a discipline and my discipline has these boundaries and I have to distinguish science from non-science, otherwise I'm not going to get published. So it's very important that everything I do falls within this domain of it's proper science, it's okay to do it. And listening with its subjectivity and are your ears listening to the same as mine and so on doesn't give me that so-called objectivity. And I recognise now that, and possibly not before, but now that looking at a picture also doesn't give me any objectivity, and that my methods are of pulling the data out of the signals are designed to pull out the data I think I want in the first place. But I don't think I'd really thought about that so explicitly before talking to Salome. And I think that in my discipline, there's a requirement for clarity. So I need to be brief and succinct and to convey the information to other scientists as briefly as I can. There's a need for consensus. So when I look at this picture and I show it to another scientist, I want them to see the same thing. And we have a sort of shared visual grammar that we've been trained in since we started doing maths at school that says that's time along the bottom and it's going to go from left to right getting later, and that's how big it is going up there, and the different colours will show different things, and how big things are it tells me something, and where they are tells me something. And if I show it to another scientist and I say, look, it's doing this, look, it's increasing, look, it's decreasing, I expect them to read it in the same way that we both read the same language or see the same letters on the page. And that shared consensus allows me very quickly to say, I'm seeing this in this data, you should see the same thing. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? Because I think if so, this theory is supported by this piece of data. And I don't have that in sound. So what is out in science is a sort of subjectivity, however much it might be there in an unacknowledged way. Obfuscation, so trying to confuse people or make things less than clear. You're always aiming for more clarity rather than less. And bespoke interpretation. I want to be in a position where when I show it to somebody, we all say, yep, we're all seeing the same thing. Now let's talk about why it's happening. So the boundaries of the discipline, the walls around it are quite clearly produced, and what's out is quite clearly specified, and it comes into your training so much as you go from being at school to through PhD and beyond, that it's not even really acknowledged that, that you've built these walls around it. So we very much have this aim to try to share the things that we're recording in a way that, that the process of sharing them or the process of analysing them is secondary to being able to discuss the underlying mechanisms and what's going on and why things are happening. And it seems to me, following long discussions in this area with Salome and others, that if we were to introduce listening into science as a methodological approach, we need to look for that same kind of shared, almost a sonic literacy, the same way that when I look at this graph, and if you plot a similar graph, I will see the same things in it. We need to have that kind of consensus in how we listen and how we describe what we're listening to and why we're listening. And to do that, you would need a sonic education that runs in a parallel to that visual and mathematical education that, that we have within science. So we have to move from within the disciplinary walls, and we just have to expand them a little more and say, we're going to include listening in the process, and here's how we're going to do it. And I think we've got to step outside that boundary, and we've got to tame a little bit of the hinterland and you know, expand our walls out to incorporate that into the process of what we're trying to do. So that's really where we're going to in the second stage of our project, I think. So Salome is going to talk to you about her perspective now and then a little bit about the new project.
Yes, I don't know what your mix is between art and science or technology, but I very much listen, I suppose, as an artist. I do not need consensus, or in actual fact, I quite like that there is none. I'd even like to upset consensus, challenge it, upset it, and to have and show how it is a construct rather than a kind of a given. It's naturalized rather than natural. And I think that's what sound art can do so fantastically. I mean, art does it in general, but I think sound art does it so fantastically because it's invisible. So we can't really see what's upsetting us, because most of the real norms are at least hyper-invisible. Hyper-invisible in the fact that they're so normal, so normative, that they have become invisible to us even when they stare us in the face. We think they cannot be other. There cannot be an other way that things are done. They sort of show us a singularity of how things are, as one actuality that is real. And we like Anna said, you know, you're sort of brought up within a discipline, or you're brought up within certain walls of thinking and doing things that you just assume, no, this is real. And obviously you are producing in a sort of tautological frame, you are producing the reality of the walls you've built. And I think, of course, the job of the artist is another one. The job of the artist is to doubt those walls, to be constantly doubting and be in angst and insecurity about what is really real. And to really, so doubt is in the very opposite of trying to find the clarity of a graph. It's more, where can I find the basis for rethinking, and that nothing is really true, and that we have to rethink it. So I want to play also a few sounds, and I start with this one, which I think for me gets us physically, experientially into this wobbly space of doubt at what it is we hear. Oops, that's not what I wanted at all.
Thank you.
I cannot play the whole piece, but this is by a composition by Lithuanian experimental musician, electroacoustic composer Turas Brumsteinas, Night on the Sailship. And sort of very in opposition to the samples we heard before, where there is a clear sense of this is giving me information about something. It starts from this other element where if I now read the title, oh, it's the night on a sailship and I can get there. But actually, sonically, it gets me to question what the night is and what the sailship is. And I'm not sure anymore what it is I really heard. And it is all kind of wobbly. And I'm literally at sea trying to figure out what this is. And my listening has to be, rather than recognizing and discovering and interpreting in a clear sense, becomes a generative listening and an innovative listening, where I invent and imagine what this is I'm hearing and thereby rethink what I thought, given the title, what it is I heard. And then I can read the sleeve notes. And the sleeve notes in this case are really, really interesting. It's on a CD called Epilogue. And the sleeve notes describe that in the olden days, the people who worked in the coulisse machinery in a theatre, so anything to do with backdrops and so on, a theatre, were sailors, because that's the skills that were needed to move this, on these ropes and move all these different things. So it's like the sailors then brought their own esoteric knowledge of their discipline to the theatre, and it becomes very interesting how they might have changed what is done there. And then Brumsteinas uses those very same backdrops and things to create this composition of a sailship in the night. And of course, we have no sailship and we have no night, but we have a composition that we listen to query all those things and to make something completely different. And if I would ask each one of you, well, what did you hear? We would have, I don't know, 30 different interpretations, and there is no need to come to one, but to maybe through our imagination and our sort of sensory engagement with the material, reimagine what the things we are given are and what they are mean now. So it is it's rather than maybe going for the search for scientific objectivity, the objectivity in this case becomes a matter for responsibility, our responsibility to be engaged in what we hear and what we do with it, and then find new words and a new way to talk about this invisible material. Another piece I'm playing has more direct, I guess, overlaps.
I was breathing.
So it's, the whole piece is freely available on YouTube, so you can see the whole bit, which is itself only the solo version of a more collaborative composition piece called the Carbon Song Cycle, also with Joanna Barbara. So it's online, and what fascinates me about this piece, it is also about breathing, so there is a real overlap, but how Pamela Z uses it much more is not necessarily to reveal to us her pathology in medical terms, but actually to expand her body, to use interactive devices and technology, to have a sort of trans-technological body that can go beyond what we might think we know when we look at her in terms of identity, in terms of age, in terms of gender. And she can invent and reinvent her body through the breath, starting with the breath as a compositional material to expand and to use these interactive devices to have feedback loops. And at the same time, while she is composing with the breath as a sound, telling us that she is breathing, and then the breathing at time through the technology gets chopped up, so sonically we might be afraid that she's not actually breathing, but she's reassuring us, I am breathing, I am breathing, I am here, I am audible, I am breathing, I'm a body, and I'm expanding into a space that maybe isn't my space, because the normative space isn't African American and isn't female. And I think so in many ways, she's upsetting, or the piece can upset the expectations of reality through breath rather than trying to find out a physical reality from the breath. And I feel that's a very interesting juxtaposition of what artists do differently. And yet, if we were to meet in that hinterland, and if we come together, what else can we find out? What else can we do together if we bring these two mindsets together rather than keeping them apart in two walled spaces? Yes, it might mean abandoning some of the securities and some of the certainties, because of course in artistic doubt there is the certainty of the artistic frame, and that's kind of the paradox. I can doubt everything and listen to the breath rather than to what it says to me about the body within the safe confines of art as a discipline or music as a discipline and its own walls and its own hinterlands. But what if we meet and if we put both our certainties into question, but actually bring the material, our attitudes, our methodologies, our thoughts together? Where could we go with it? And I think that's, to me, very exciting on an academic level, on a scholarship level, on a scientific level, but I think almost, it's almost become a political level, because I really feel we have to, wherever possible, not accept the walled-in spaces and understand that a wall is not a partition. There is no inside or out, and sound really tells us that, because sound is indivisible, and sound will come through a wall. It doesn't obey visual delineations of geography or of architecture. It just comes through, and it goes around the wall. So it questions the inside and out, and always reminds us that the wall cannot separate us. It's actually, the wall is part of the inside and the outside, and there is none of that certainty, which I think has implications and can get us to a new imaginary in relation to academics, but also in relation to politics and the politics of academia, which there's also politics. So Listen Across Disciplines, which is going to start in January, is kind of grown up from this network where it really was surveying the field. It was looking at who was listening, who was not listening, why were they not listening, how could we listen together, or can we listen together, into now a project that starts from those very issues of that we found, and some of the partners that we met in the network grant we're now going to work with over the next 3 years to really do something, hopefully, maybe on one level is tangible and could bring something methodological and certain to both disciplines and bring them together. But I think also the thinking and in the encounter between the different disciplines, something else could happen. So what is Listening Across Disciplines? Its aims are to work in the first instance with partners who do listen, to learn from them. So these are urban designers, people working in the urban environment who use listening and sounding and sound making as a as a way to understand how an urban environment is built and how else it could be built, to listen to people working in speech therapy, speech synthesis, to see how do they deal with listening to deaf speech and to the sort of automation of speech, to people working in auscultation, so the training of stethoscope listening, and to people listening in an anthropological sense, to meet them and to discuss with them from our own disciplines, can we come up with a protocol? Can we come up with something that we could share, that could be like a blueprint that we could all use together? And can we also together start building a glossary on the vocabulary that would help us communicate with each other? Always knowing that maybe we can never communicate with each other, but at least we can give it a go. And we can try and find some words that will make sense. And then hopefully we will come up with a sort of a prototype protocol, something that we can use, which we then bring to disciplines that work with sound, but do not listen. So acoustics, funny enough, doesn't listen. They work with sound, they do not listen. So we will be working with acoustics, and we will be working with curation, who also deal with sounds, sonic artifacts, sonic objects, sonic education, but do not have listening in their methodology as such. It becomes either semantic listening or almost quasi-visual listening. And to see, well, okay, we have this protocol. Can you try it? Can we try it out with you? And what's going to happen? And so hopefully that will help us to make our protocol clearer, more nuanced, more usable, or we might dismiss it and just say, no, it doesn't work. But hopefully it will work, so that in a further phase, we will bring it to a discipline that does neither listen nor have sound, but that whose data we will look at and sonify to then listen and see whether, if that works, every discipline, every investigation, any way we're trying to figure out things about the world, about ourselves and about things in the world, could in theory be augmented and advanced through listening one way or another, either via sonification, via translation process, or directly. The issue of listening across disciplines is never to dismiss the visual. It's to augment, it's to add, it's to challenge and to work with. And really, I suppose, in the end, what we have is a multisensory. Because I think one of the most interesting conversations was that all of a sudden, Anna was also hearing a body or feeling a body. There was a body in the room all of a sudden. If you take the graphs out of the equation, you have a human being, so you have a body. So it becomes, listening is somewhere not only an access point to the hinterlands, it's also an access point to the multisensory and the multisensory knowledge. So I hope this has sort of summed up where we hope to go. But we want to sort of enroll you a little bit or trial a little bit what this is. So in our search for the pre-protocol, we will ask each other a few questions, and we would very much like, after we've warmed up the floor a little bit with our questions, maybe that you could also answer them from your own disciplinary perspectives or add further questions to this disciplinary meeting of how could we, vocal protocols mean, how could they be created, and so on and so on. So I have questions for you, and you have questions for me. Have you left them over here? And if you have good ideas, I will write them down. Yes, and then we'll get used to. Yeah, then we're used to. Shall I ask? Yes. One? Yes. I mean, can you hear? Because now we're not amplified. So we're going to speak a bit louder. So how do you listen to breath?
Now, how I listen to breath. I do listen to my recordings now, and I think that's quite important. And I also play them back to the people I've recorded. Well, before we just said, oh, well, thanks for that, and we took them away. I now play them back. And those particular recordings that I was playing, we're hoping to use for education about what might be happening to early stage smokers. So particularly for teenage smoking education, we want to use those to say, listen to that, that's just the start of it. So we're listening differently. Well, the fact that we're listening at all is new, I think. But now my postgrads and I try to talk about what we're hearing as well. We try to say, did you hear that bit? And sometimes you can see things in the pictures that you can't hear, and sometimes you can hear things in the sounds that you can't see in the pictures. So it is informing how we conduct the analysis, how sensitive we make the analysis sometimes, and whether we should really be picking out things that you can't hear when we're going to feed this back as information to clinicians who are going to use listening to try to put it into practice.
So do you think that hearing could change the visual, the visualization, so that you discuss it and that you now listen? Do you think you might say, well, we need to change our visualization methods?
I certainly think it calls into question whether being able to see something but not hear it is at all useful in this kind of application of what we're doing. Because if you can't hear it, it's not a sound, is it? It's something in the data, but it's not a sound. So if we're talking about lung sounds, it does call that into question quite significantly.
So what new knowledge do you think listening gets you sort of on for the aims that your listening has?
Well, for me, one of the things that really is clear is it becomes people. It really does, because you record the person, you hear them breathing while you're recording them, and then you go away and you listen to it again. You think, oh, that was that person who looked like this. It does make it much more... I sort of thought of the lungs as a black box, and stuff goes into it and stuff comes out of it, and some of what comes out is the sound, and I want to separate that from the things. But it was a very systems approach. And if I think about the lungs, I just think about the lungs. And it was always a shock if I go to the hospital to record that the lungs were going to be inside a person and the person wasn't terribly attractive. I mean, they're not very well and they don't look good and they're not enticing in some sense. And now that's with me when I'm dealing with the sounds as well. So that's quite a big change that I think we need to do this because these people are going to be very ill if we don't do something. So it changes the space you're working in a way that I really didn't expect.
Mm. And so if we want to make a protocol, we need words. And you say you started talking with your students about what you hear. Mm. What words do you use?
Well, there are clinical words for the sounds that we heard, and they're sort of onomatopoeic. So in the later stage, you might have heard a wheeze somewhere in there, and some of the sounds are called crackles. So the wheeze comes from the airways fluttering. As you breathe in hard, the airway flutters and it produces like a bassoon reed, so it's like a double reed process. And the crackles come from the airways. They're sometimes stuck shut, either because they've lost the structural integrity to stay open, which is what they're meant to do, or because there's something blocking them. So you hear the sort of a noise, and they call that a crackle. So there's the clinical words, but Well, we were a bit short of words. That's one of the problems. If you don't use the clinical words, and the clinicians talk about wet crackles and dry crackles, and there's one comes at the end of the inspiration phase, which is very very small signal, but it sounds like Velcro. They call it Velcro crackles. And it's a really not an organic kind of sound. It's not. It makes your lungs sound really mechanical somehow. We can play again maybe.
And I'm really curious. Do you think the people who you play it to, the teenagers, so they don't smoke, are they more persuaded by a graph or by the sounds?
We haven't really tried yet. But I think the sound, the idea that last sound is a lung, to me is quite unpleasant, quite mechanical. I think, you know, if your joints creak, you think, I'm getting old, aren't I? And if you hear your lung creak, then it's a big floppy thing normally. It's not. I think it will be quite interesting to see if it does have a good effect. But I'm interested the other way around, that art brings a lack of consensus. But how do you think we're going to use the art to move from the act of listening to a protocol that says to people, listen like this or listen like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what I hope that art can bring a bit is that kind of never being really sure what you listen for, or that what you listen for is not important. It's not, oh, yeah, now I've heard a sail ship, or now I've heard a lung. that it's not about recognizing what you hear, but more kind of this engagement in, well, what does this sound like and what does it, how do I respond to it physically? And that's why I sort of hope, I also hope, obviously, the teenagers will feel almost physically, oh my God, I don't want my lungs to hear like that. And I think that's the capacity sound has. The capacity sound has is to kind of really demand this engagement of you. And there's a reciprocity because I breathe too. And then if I hear that, and then I think, oh my God, my lungs will sound like that. So that there is more a participation in sound. And maybe the participation is the bit art can bring, and the reciprocity, an acknowledgement that I sound as well. And you sound when you do the recording, and you have lungs and the body when you do the recordings of lungs, and that it's not abstraction, and that we are not so sure anymore and have to come to another certainty. And on that way, hopefully some other idea of what it actually is.
So that is, in some sense, isn't it, a moving together, that I didn't listen, and when I did, it became somehow more embodied. Mm. And you're saying, for listening in art, actually it doesn't matter what it is sometimes.
No, it matters it's what the sound, it does.
The sound
what
is more
the
important
sound
than
does
the production.
Than what it is, and then that, what the sound does, means what does it do to the listener or with the listener? And what do my sounds do with the listening? And so I think this kind of also responsibility I quite like, that we are engaged in our interpretations and what we hear. And so we automatically have to question our biases and whether we just hear what we expect to hear or whether we could hear something else. And the kind of these imaginaries, and maybe these can push scientific boundaries. Mm. Like we think we know what a lung is, but maybe we don't.
It'd be interesting to play that last sound of mine again and see what other people describe it as or what they hear. Now you know a bit more about what's in it, maybe.
This one, the late one.
Yes, that's the... It's about 20 years of smoking, this one.
I mean, musically speaking, it sounds like a snare drum, you know, going slightly wonky. Yes. But I wouldn't want my lungs to sound like that, you know. Kind of. Yes. Once you tell me what it is, it's frightening because then I get a physical sense of it. Mm. But what, yeah. I don't know what happens, so I don't. Why the lung sounds like that.
It's all biological.
It's
all biological. So it's a digital stethoscope, which is just like a stethoscope, but with a microphone. So it's right on the chest wall. There's not any projection, although the crackling noises you can hear in people's mouths if you know to listen for them. But it's actually on the back, on the bases of the lungs, which are the ones that get clogged first. And it's all biological.
So it sounds like static.
Yeah. That's the tissue ripping apart.
So it's very clicky. I thought it was like, you know, glitch stuff that was produced by like data computing, you know, kind of like accentuating the breathing effects or the artifacts in the breathing. Mm. So I thought it was not like 100% biological. I thought it was like
no, that's just tissue noise.
Yeah. Okay. No.
I mean, some of it's mucus. Unsticking,
yeah,
and some of it's tissue unsticking, and some of it's just you get scarring in what they call the parenchyma around the airways, and so it's just really stiff compared to how it should be. So it expands with a kind of rip.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example. I think, like yourself, I thought that was a problem in clipping, a problem in mediation. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, yeah, interesting that those two issues or problems of transference sound so similar.
Yeah. Mm.
And I mean, I don't know whether you're here as a sound artist or as a technologist, or, but I, you know, if you, probably, yeah, the hour, if the majority of us work with sound in an artistic way, we're very inclined to think, no, this is clipping, this is glitch, or how would I use this in a composition? You know, you're sort of already working with it, and we're not really going to engage too much in the smoker's lung, probably, you know, for whatever reason. And I think that's interesting, that obviously there's biases on both sides, so there's limits, there's walls on both sides of how we treat what we hear. And I think that's what I find this very exciting hinterland, you know, where we can meet and where something else can happen and where a new knowledge can be uncovered, mm-hmm. where, yes, there is an aesthetics to this. We come at it as an artist. I come at it with an aesthetic knowledge of clips and glitches and recordings. Whereas you come at it from a sort of bioacoustic medical expectation of, no, I know these are lungs, so you start with knowing what they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very interesting because one opens us also up to a different imagination then.
I suppose it kind of begs the question as well, to what extent those responses to technical issues are the product of biological processes that we have some awareness of, but not of, that those things are linked in ways that
Yeah. Or even just and maybe a bit of outrage that I said I was going to play you natural sounds and I've brought you a rubbish recording of something that is, you know, that surely she could have cleaned it up a bit, you know. Yes, but where I've come across sonification of scientific data, it's whatever the person doing the sonifying has said, unless it's very simplistic that high pitches are related to high frequency, it's always seemed to speak more to the artistic output than it has back to the scientific. And I think that's one of those things that we would really like to explore is our last set of data that we hope to work with is from somebody at London School of Economics who's looking at social exclusion. So they have this data set about economic background and health and schooling and education and later career and so on, and looking at whether we can not just make that sound nice or install it in a place that's got some relevance to social exclusion, but actually come back to the science of it and say, we've got something out of this data set that we didn't know just from plotting the graphs or interviewing the people in the first place, or, you know, is it just an aesthetic thing, or can we really use that sonification to come back to the technical and create or find in that data set some new information? I think that's a really interesting question. We do know we were working with, or we went to a meeting where there was someone who was working with an astronomer. A sonification person working with an astronomer, and they work very well together, but it still didn't seem to give back to the astronomy in some way.
It was very beautiful, you know, very beautiful compositions about astronomy, and there's nothing wrong with using sonification to make compositions, but then the outcome is a composition that doesn't necessarily say anything about astronomy if you come from it from that point. And I think there is a obviously, with the graphs you showed, we still have to learn it, and we learn it so clearly in school that we don't even think that we've learned it. We just think we can read a graph. We know how to read a graph, but it's a visualization process that we've learned. And I suppose sonification could work in a similar way, but it needs, as you say, it probably take time, that it also needs the education. How do we listen to it? And that there is another expectation. As part of the network, we interviewed somebody in CERN, and we talked about this issue because they had a sonifier in. But the reason they worked with the composer was to persuade the people who lived there that it was all lovely what was going on in the Hadron Collider, and that it wasn't dangerous, and that it was wonderful, and that they shouldn't be buried living on top of it. And I think, yes, that is one aim, and that is okay. And it's a kind of pseudo-education. But it's also dangerous, because you can just gloss over difficult things and say, no, this CERN division is not dangerous, it all sounds lovely. Rather than actually I've gleaned something, whereas if you go into CERN, there's loads of visualization machines and loads of visualization apparatus that they know how to read. I don't know how to read. I have no idea how to read them, but all the physicists who work there do. So it is learnable. But maybe it's a cultural issue of how do we bring this into school? How do we make the sonic knowledge equally important? And then how do we differentiate between a sonification that is a composition and a sonification that is a translation and an interpretation?
Yeah. There was a study, and I read about this about 15 or 16 years ago, so that my details are going to be vague, but it was looking at salination levels in sea, and they were looking at sonification purely for the reason that because of our abilities with auditory scene analysis and that idea that we can multiply hear and follow loads of different data, you know, if you think about the string quartet or something like that, they were representing the data by filtering white noise with vowel and voice sounds, because we can hear those with our ears, in a way that allowed them to simultaneously hear groups of data that they weren't able to visually represent. And it just always struck me that there is, in terms of like your question about what can we glean through listening, there are some abilities we have in our sort of ability to simultaneously hear that we don't have viewing wise that might offer.
Yeah, and this astronomy, they'd taken the sounds which were derived from the astronomical data and put them in a tower, a building that was a tower, and as you went up, the sounds related to things further away. So from an outreach point of view, from the point of view of explaining science in an accessible form, I see that it has benefits. It's the reflection back into the data. So that I will have a look for that study, because that would be interesting to know. Yeah. There's somebody over there.
Yeah, as a smoker, I find that absolutely horrific.
I'm sorry. I do apologise to anyone who is.
When you said, let's play that again, I was like, oh, God. But I suppose part of it is actually as you say, it's a totally natural sound, but a lot of it does appear so synthetic. You're getting these kind of, you know, swells and white noise and this glitch with like a kick drum somewhere in there. The bit that really got me, though, was the one part that seems almost animalistic with the wheeze.
Yeah.
You get this kind of yelp almost through it, but it's like,
yeah.
But one thing I was just considering there when you were talking about the sonification thing, so in the graph analysis that you've done, there's some sort of feature extraction or feature detection to group the different colors and parts or elements that make up the overall sound. But I wondered what it might be like if you used that technique, but to take the presumably mono recording and then spatialize it so you know what groups you're looking for, but you could have them appear at predefined locations, so you'd be able then to go, right, there's a lot of stuff happening on the right, that's not a good place.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, rather than...
We could, I suppose, spatialize it, because you've got two halves and three lobes on one side and two lobes on the other in the lung, so you could spatialize it according to the lung or according to the type of sound, which is to some extent also according to to where in the lung. So that's quite interesting. I'm actually working with some Iranian artists who are interested in the opium trade and want to use those sounds to depict what... Well, actually, they want to make a simulation, let it run for as long as the opium trade has, so it would be like a really, really old smoker by the end of the exhibition. And they want to have the sound coming from different positions from a sort of artistic sensibility. So we might look at that as well in terms of how the lungs work. But it did occur to me that the same way that we shame smokers by making them stand outside the walls these days, we could actually make you all wear something so you could hear what you sounded like and, you know, and then broadcast it to other people. It would be quite entertaining, wouldn't it?
But it is also, and I haven't thought about that before, there's also obviously a finance issue. you know, whereas you're probably used to spending your money on visualization and on everything that goes with that. Like in CERN, like I said, there was loads of visualizations, and that's what they all looked at. Like, they look at screens 24 hours a day. There's always some physicist sitting behind a glass window. You can watch them. It's like going to a zoo, where they watch what's going on the ground, and they watch these screens of visualization. And when I interviewed David Goldblatt, he sort of explained, and we talked about it, and I said, well, why don't you work with sound? And although he enjoys music and was a musician or is a musician, he said, well, he wouldn't know how to listen to it. But then also came the idea of finance. You know, how would we record it? Because he said, oh, there's not a lot of space down there. We would need some really, really small microphones. And he wasn't against the idea, but it's a money side. So you all of a sudden needed to have money to say, okay, now we're going to record the lungs from four angles. So we need different stethoscope, we need stereostethoscopy, we need more complex machines to record. So I think that's really interesting, that our protocols might have financial implications.
And there are people who record in multiple recordings, and we've been concentrating on something that's kind of clinically adoptable. And if you ask the GP to do something too complicated, they just won't pick it up, whereas they do use a stethoscope all the time. One of the things I find quite interesting about the digital stethoscope has been around 10 years or so now. I think 3M make a nice one for £300 or £400. It's not really a lot more expensive than a really high-quality analogue stethoscope, but it hasn't been picked up because the GP doesn't have a way of storing the files. And if you went to the GP and said your blood pressure's up, you would expect that they'd recorded it before and written it down, and that when they're saying it's up, that it was on some basis. But they listen to your lungs, and then they listen to them again another time, but there's no recording. However simple it is to do it, there's no recording of what happened last time. So they say, there's a funny noise there. You say, was it there last time? Don't know. And if that was your blood pressure, you'd be horrified if they said, I've just measured it, it's 98 over 130. I've no idea what it was last time, so it's either up or down. It seems to me it's such a simple thing to record it. But
a question about that, and that in relation to what's come out of your project. I'm just wondering if there's any sort of shift in thinking about sound as data within the academy. Because I'm someone who's coming as an artist into And that idea that it's simple things like the interview becomes a transcript, like we sort of silence everything, and even just trying to, I'm finding, you want to submit things to the way we're spreading knowledge through journals, is that I want to put this as a sound evidence, and it's like, oh no, you've got to do a transcript or it's printed, and we somehow sort of pretend that the recording process is invisible and doesn't exist, like the words just magically appear as a piece of text. Mm-hmm. And we somehow lose all that data that comes with sound. I just wondered, in terms of what you're doing, like that idea of keeping the stethoscope recordings, because that's important, like whether you started to see any shift in people thinking about how we might accept or distribute sonic data, not as a recording of the data of something that was sonic, but actually sound itself.
Lots of journals have a sort of extra items area now, don't they? They have a web page where you can put more pictures that you can fit in the journal, and I guess you can put sound files as well.
Yeah.
But it certainly exists. I mean, I think I've come across it more as at least as a question. You know, if you think of people like Adriana Cavarero, etc., where it is discussed, what is this mute knowledge that we have? Why? What is writing? What is theoretical writing? And is theoretical writing mute? And should it be performed? We did a conversation on a train between us about consensus and listening. And yes, to put it into a journal, we then transcribed it. Mm. But obviously there was a performance. There was an event that was happening. And so this is also, and this is another encounter that is live, that is recorded, and that can remain as sound. Because I completely agree, as much as there is sounds in the lung that doesn't translate into the visualization, there is the sonority between us when we talk that doesn't translate into a semantic understanding. And that is another of those knowledges that I'm really interested in. How can we bring that, or bring the imagination of that into the discourse and into the discipline, and make it count, make it be able to affect something and impact on what knowledge is and what learning is and what in the end also teaching is. I mean, you know, that But I think we all have to work on that and the curiosity of what is involved in that sonorous stuff rather than in what we can know what it is.
Yeah. And you can now enter the academy as a sound artist, so that's a step, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.